We've got a really good one for you this week. I did an interview with one of the original members of Maybird, Dylan Willick, who I think most people on the team won't know. I think that was just kind of long enough ago. I think we reflected on this maybe in the episode or maybe before when we were chatting, but all of the people from that first era of Maybird, I think, have moved on now.
Yeah.
I think. So it was really good. I recorded that a couple weeks ago, but before that, we did have a few cool things we wanted to go over that we didn't want to let sit. I don't think we quite got through everything last week, so there are a few things we want to run over before my interview with Dylan. Start us off.
The really cool one was Zoe LeClaire winning first place in the under 19 in the Leadville stage race.
Yeah. Which is a pretty big deal. Like, that's
super
legit.
Cool. Yeah. And she's just been just on fire, crushing it. Yeah. I'm super excited for Zoe.
Having just about as good a season as you could.
Yeah. So keep it up. Keep having fun.
In cycling world news, decide if I'm too lazy to cut that later. Cycling world news, though, we had the Tour de France Femme has wrapped, and it was won, I think, maybe somewhat surprisingly, by Pauline Ferrand-Prevot. And if that's not a name you know, if you got into this maybe 5 years ago, that might not be a name that you know. But Pauline Ferrand-Prevot emerged right as we were getting into this. She's French, in case you couldn't tell. And she and Yolande Neff had a rivalry for 3 or 4 seasons in the World Cups, back and forth. Prevot, I think, is in the GOAT conversation now. She has the distinction, like prior to this, I think she'll probably be known by most people as a Tour de France winner. I think she almost should be better known though for, I believe it was 2015, there was a brief point in time where she held 3 world titles at once. She had the rainbow jersey on the road, in cyclocross, and in mountain bike at the same time. And this was like 10 years ago. And she had some health problems and then a couple bad crashes and bumped through a couple different teams. She was on Ineos briefly, but then got picked up by Visma. And seems to be a little more focused on the road exclusively, and came and won the tour. As a rider who really is predominantly an off-road rider, coming, winning the tour, really, really cool to see.
I didn't even really realize she was a road cyclist, though.
No, because she had, like I said, she I think really, and I want to say she came up in cross. I think that's true. That might not be true. But when we got into it, she was like primarily a mountain biker, but showed up to Worlds. And, it's a mountain biker winning a 1 day race is, it's doable, like it's a longer race, but to go and be able to win a week long grand tour is awesome. So I want to throw out, I know that Marianne Vos, I think, is generally looked at as the GOAT. I think you could make a good argument for Prevot though. And to have all of these accomplishments like 10 years apart, that, she's not one of these flash in the pan, have a great season, get on an 8 million euro contract, and then you never hear from him again. Like, it's really, really cool.
Yeah, that's definitely a big deal.
Really, really cool. If you didn't hear, did we talk about the World Cup last week?
Oh, no.
World Cup announcement. I didn't think we did. I think that dropped right after. But we will be getting a mountain bike World Cup here in Utah at Soldier Hollow. This is a big deal. Like, having American World Cups is a big deal. My wife's from Montreal, right? And we always talk that, like, oh, well, 1 year we need to go there because they have the Mont Saint-Anne World Cup. That's the closest to World Cup's ever going to get. We have to go see Mont Saint-Anne. We're going to have one in Heber. Like, yeah. I could get in my car and, like, drive there before the sun sets.
They had one in Snowshoe.
Well, they had a lot, like 20. Well, no, they had, because they had, well, so I'm kind of getting that, because they had, and then they had one in New York when I was in high school, and then they had Snowshoe, but still like across the country, right? Yeah. That's about as far away. So that they're going to have one, not only in America, but in your backyard. So we, Dan, and there are people, I don't know if maybe, and maybe we'll cut this because you'll have a different take. Someone said on the ride yesterday, they're like, just watch Nika like schedule a race on top of that. And I was like, you should skip the race then. You should see the World Cup. You, whatever is going on in your year next year, you need to make sure that you are in town to see the World Cup. That is a thing that might not happen again for you. And if it does, it'll be a long time. Like this is a big deal. You are going to get to see the pinnacle of your sport in your backyard.
So I was always hoping that if they ever had a World Cup in Utah, it would be somewhere a little more iconic. Like,
okay, so I'm glad that you're opening the door to this. I'm ecstatic that we're getting one. I don't think that Soldier Hollow is the best representation of the mountain biking that we have to offer.
It's awful.
Like it's not like
it's a good race venue. It's a good awful mountain bike.
Yeah, I think they selected it probably because it's practical.
Oh yeah, definitely. It's, you know, yeah. I mean, they've got the parking. And they've got the parking.
You can
park there. So
it's the best parking lot with a trail attached to it. But it's cool. I don't want to rain on it. I do kind of agree. It would be cool to do. I think it should be a Red Rock thing.
I know.
I think that's what Utah has. Because even like Park City is like Switzerland, and that's what makes it cool. I don't think we. I mean, like we've had. You know, like that would be really neat. That would be unique.
I know, to see like world class riders racing on slick rock.
And here's the thing, dude. Here's the thing: are there not fields where you can set up World Cups in Southern Utah? Like St. George is like a huge city. There's hotels. There's like, I don't know. I'm thrilled though. So you need to be there to see it. Dates haven't been announced yet, but keep an eye out for those because you need to be there. In the more immediate future, we should also throw out, I think we skipped over, iCup Snowbird. We talked about this last week. Yeah. iCup Snowbird will be on Saturday. You should go to that. It's great. We kind of pointed out, it's kind of unique. You know, if you've only done Nike racing, or honestly, even if you've only done some of the other iCups, like Snowbird's sort of classic, rough single track that's not really even designed for mountain, but like...
It's old school.
It's chunky old school steep
up
climbs.
One way, down yep. the other kind of mountain bike racing.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's the same day as Leadville. So anybody racing pro, your competition might be weeded down. If you want to win an iCup, this might be your best opportunity. To the Maybird riders doing Leadville, which was my sneaky little segue there. I do want to wish Riker good luck at Leadville. I don't know that we have other.
Yeah, we might have others. I'm just
we not... might, as always. The team's getting big. Please let us know if you want a shout out. That would be fine by us. Best of luck to Riker. Outside of that, you'd mentioned it's, you know.
Well, you know, the first Nike races are in like a couple weeks.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
That's wild.
And, we usually do our most Nikeful time of the year episode. We haven't done one yet this year.
Well, maybe hit that. Maybe. I don't know.
We'll see.
It's kind of, I don't know if you haven't prepped. I think we've also sort of realized that the listenership of this show does lean pretty heavily toward people who are not going to be like, oh shoot, I listen to the cycling podcast every week, but I forgot to do any cycling this year. Like,
yeah, I was going to say something, you know, if you haven't started training, it's probably time to get riding consistently, but pretty sure people listening to this are riding consistently. Yeah. If not, and you need to get ready for Nike quick, reach out. We'll talk.
We'll figure out a crash course. I do want to say, if we don't end up doing a Nike full thing, the one thing I'd want to leave you with, if this is like your first Nike season, there are two or three main points that I do want to let you know. The first is that you have the privilege and the pain of being a youth mountain biker in Utah. At a time where we're kind of having a renaissance in the sport, the competition's really stiff. Winning a Nike race is a big, 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 big deal. And you're going to have more competition than literally any other race you could possibly have done. So I do think that, like, you know, if you've done a lot of midweeks and you know, like don't be discouraged if you show up to Nike and it feels like really steep competition. There's a million kids there. Nike racing is kind of its own style. You know, because of the nature of the venues that they need to use to accommodate the people, it is fast, chaotic, dusty racing with people who may or may not have like the skills, especially if you're racing some of the younger groups, you have really fit kids where like the handling skills might not be there. It feels crashy and chaotic. Like if you're new to it, you know, like don't be married to like, well, I got to get on the podium. 'Cause you don't know, there's a lot of really good kids. And the second thing I'd throw out is the Nike season is really long. In the Nike Full episode, it always comes up that it kind of seems like, you know, sometimes there'll be like some kid you've never heard of runs away from the crowd and wins the first one by 5 minutes. And then by state champs, he's, you know, 18th place or whatever. It's pretty rare to get, even when I was doing it in the competition, it's pretty rare to have somebody win every single race. That generally doesn't happen. Like, things get mixed up. It's a long season. You probably can't be your peak self for every single Nike race. Some people come in hot and then they're kind of on their knees by the time you hit states. Other people, you know, kind of take some time to get going. And then by states, their legs are really under them. So,
yeah. And that's usually the gist of the Nike Full episode is that, like, it usually takes 6 to 8 weeks to really get in your top race form.
Yeah.
But once you're in your top race form, you can only maintain it for a few weeks. So
yeah,
it's really hard to be in top form all Nike season long. And, you know, so
yeah,
we'll probably talk about that a little more next week. But
yeah,
the one thing I did want to say too is that, like, a lot of times, like, July is just so hot, brutal. And I think it's probably the hardest month to be motivated to ride your bike.
Yeah.
You know, I think August starts cooling down a little bit, September even more.
September and October are just glorious, amazing, you know.
You know, like, just stay consistent. It's tough right now. It takes a little more mental energy, but the riding's going to get awesome. It's going to get better.
Yeah.
Just hang in there. Consistency is the magic. Like,
yep.
It's not what intervals you're doing. It's how consistent you are.
Really. Yeah.
So
if you're in a funk, don't worry. I think everybody kind of gets into a funk at some point.
I think a lot of people
get
in a funk in July, especially.
It's rough. It's hot, you know.
I kind of was. I'm pretty motivated now.
Yeah. So, outside of that, did we cover all the things?
Yeah, probably not, but I think we're good enough.
Good stuff. I hope you guys enjoy the interview. Dylan is a really interesting guy, and it was cool to catch up with him. If you guys have any questions, send them our way. Ride safe. Stay cool. Talk to you guys next week. If we go back to year one of Maybird, it was 10, 15-ish people. And it was basically like our friend group.
It was basically Skyline mountain bike team plus a couple of our friends from Nike.
I don't know that anybody... Was anybody on Maybird that wasn't on Skyline back then? Did we have any...
There may not have been anybody.
We did. We had like Spencer Davies and the Logan guys.
So yeah.
We did have a couple.
There were like two. And that first year was 2017, 2018, which would have been my senior year of high school.
Yeah.
And you would have just graduated. So you were already like in a coaching role.
Kind of, yeah.
Sort of.
And I was just realizing, it occurs to me that I don't know that we've ever interviewed. I think we might have interviewed Spencer Davies a long time ago. I don't remember, but...
Back when you were using the integrated sound system on your Mac?
These mics are slightly better, yes. But it's been a minute, so I want to kind of start that you and I were really close friends in high school.
Yeah, so we've known each other since 2014.
Well, let's go even before that, because we met each other through the bike team. How did you find your way to this? Because it wasn't as big a thing back then. Like, the Skyline team was only 20-ish kids.
So I would have joined the Skyline mountain bike team in, I guess it would have been the 2014 summer.
Yeah.
As a like rising freshman at Skyline. I think there were certainly no more than 15 of us on the team. Maybe it was 12.
That first year. Because I think we started the same year.
Yes.
That wasn't a year where you didn't, I didn't. But I was a year.
Because you didn't you didn't race as a freshman.
No.
So we were on the team back in the very early days, and I joined with basically my three closest friends, and we all just started riding. I remember the first ride with the team. We were out in we're at like the north part of BST, over like before it went further north into Ogden, and I just remember getting absolutely whooped.
Oh yeah.
I remember being
that was my first practice too.
So worked.
Yeah. Cause like you were even more athletic than me going in, cause you'd been like skiing and stuff your whole life. And I'd imagine, right, like your parents were, you know, like Mount Rupp, kind of everyone around here, like their parents used to mountain bike a bit. It's like a thing you'd done.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely like had some experience on a bike, had the skiing legs, and some soccer legs, which help, miss those. We'll get to that part. I remember just, and I'm sure everyone listening can relate to this, your first mountain bike ride is so humbling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, it's like those steep switchbacks where the grade pitches up to 25-30% for even just a moment, and you're like, oh my God.
Yeah. No, because for like my first one, it was like trying to follow, it was like you, Alex Kitchens, and Tanner Pulley or something like that. Like,
and Nick Loyola's up, you know, looking beautiful a mile ahead, not working hard at all.
And then we did, and you and I were kind of like, I feel like you and I were, like, everybody on the team liked bikes. I think you and I kind of had a different, like, it was almost like we weren't even, like, in love with, we were, like, codependent in a toxic relationship with bikes because we were so completely obsessed with it, and neither of us knew how to regulate our competitive.
Yeah. Like, well, and then I had to break up with bikes a little bit, junior and senior year. I didn't race junior year for mental health reasons. And then I raced a little bit senior year, but I got used to freshman and sophomore year being one of the fastest people in the field.
Yeah.
And then that stopped happening. And yep. I kind of had a breakdown.
This is something that comes up on the podcast all the time, because it's something that we see happen to people. And for me, like, I kind of had my crisis. Like, I did sophomore my first year and then did really well, right? And then did varsity junior and senior year and just, like, did not have the results I thought I should have. And then after that, I kind of took, I mean, I did, I raced, like, the year after, but then, you know, COVID rolled around and I didn't race for, like, 2 years.
Yeah, and I mean, I totally reestablished my relationship with biking through college. I rode a single speed around campus and like around town, and I rode a old cyclocross bike as a gravel bike, and just completely disconnected myself from the competitive side of cycling, with the exception of, you know, a quick hill climb here or there, and really just learned to love the bike as a way to move. And we'll get to this again, but the bike continues to be just a wonderful mobility device. And I think that's something that people don't talk about a lot, is the bicycle as a mobility device rather than as a piece of sporting equipment.
Because I do think it's true that if you live in Utah, the bike is probably sporting equipment for you. Like, there are very few places you can live in Utah where you can get around primarily on a bike. It's not...
Yeah, there's not a lot of... I mean, there are some, of course, but there's not a lot of bike commuters, and there's not a lot of, you know, biking just as means of transportation, because it's hilly and it's hot
and cold.
It's snowy. Yeah. There's like 4 weeks a year where it's actually comfortable to commute.
Well, everything's far.
If you don't have a shower at work, you just like can't.
Well, and it's like everything's far apart, you know, so it's, and I've kind of felt that too.
Yay for urban sprawl.
Well, there you go. So you finish high school, kind of not sure you feel about bikes. You go to college.
Go to college.
You went to college in Minnesota.
Yep. Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota, where, I mean, honestly, a gravel haven. I could be on gravel within 5 minutes of getting on my bike at my dorm and ride as long as I could.
Yeah.
Could probably have ridden all the way to Kansas.
And you were there for 4 years, right?
I was there for 4 full years. Did quite a bit of riding in that time. I also did some fat biking out there. That was fun. I once rode in minus 55 degree wind chill at night.
Minnesota, because my wife's she lives in Montreal part of the year. I've always wondered why people live there, like, at all. Why anybody would ever sell. I'm actually curious. We haven't talked a lot about this. Like, would you ever go back and live in Minnesota?
No, unless I found, like, the perfect small town near the Boundary Waters or something like that. that was just run down and rustic, and I could just be at peace or something. But no,
like, I get the appeal, but it sounds rough a lot of the year.
I really value having mountains in my life. Yeah. I like knowing which way is north and south because there's a constant reference point.
Right.
Which it took me a long time to learn.
So you come back here, what, summer of 23? It would have been?
No, summer of 2022.
So summer of 22, you come back. And I remember we did like one ride. You got back. We did a ride at Summit Park.
Yeah. And I was, at that time, I was really becoming a climber more than a cyclist.
Like, you weren't spending a huge amount of time
on the bike. I would get on the bike, you know, maybe once a week, maybe once every other week. It was not my focus at that point. You know, I still enjoyed the bike, still, you know, liked getting out on the bike, went to the nines a couple times, but no, my focus transitioned more into climbing at that point.
Because I remember that it was like, I've never been a climber. I remember you and a couple of my other friends were harassing me to climb all the time. And we went on a ride kind of late summer. And then I remember I was up at Alta coaching a Maybird ride. And I got a call from Tessa that you'd had an accident in Little Cottonwood earlier that day. I remember that really clearly because we were up at like Devil's Castle. Like, we were a minute from the car and we were kind of going to turn back. And then you don't remember much of that day.
I've never even heard this story before.
So I don't know if I told you that, but yeah, I was up, I was in Little Cottonwood, and this would have been in the evening, and she called me.
I would have been out of there at that point, but yes.
And she said, "Hey, I just wanted to let you know. I just heard that Dylan had a really bad accident." And I asked how bad, and she said, "Well, he's in the hospital." And that's kind of what I know. And that, like, she, like, our whole friend group sort of connected, hearing different things from different places. And so I remember getting, because I had like 10 kids with me, right? So we all ride down, and I got to the car, and I sort of hop into the car, and I called both of my brothers, because I called Tessa back. She didn't pick up, so I called both of my brothers. They hadn't heard anything. And then the news kind of started to slowly trickle in through the rest of the day. What's the kind of gap in your memory from
really about 17 days, and then you add another week of very fuzzy
sort of
haze?
You were in a coma? No, kind of.
I was not in a full coma. I was in an opioid induced sleep. I was in, or I don't know, your body shuts down and doesn't put any energy into anything other than recovery for a while.
To maybe flashback to kind of explain. Yeah. Earlier that day in Little Cottonwood Canyon.
So earlier that day in Little Cottonwood Canyon, I was climbing the Classic Thumb. We were approaching the first pitch, or somewhere adjacent to the first pitch, when my partner pulled out a 10-ton refrigerator-sized block and fell with it onto me, and then I fell another 60 feet after getting hit by the rock. And then I got long-lined off of a ledge, and I got, you know, taken to the U via IHC, which is a little bit of a long story. And then I was, you know, pretty much fully asleep for about 14 days, kind of on and off for the next three, and then in a very significant, like, painkiller haze for the next week. And so there's really, you know, a three-week gap in my memory where all I remember is sort of kind of glimpses of my old life and like glimpses of the hospital mixed together, and where I was, felt like I was dreaming about, like, having lots of dreams about being in the hospital at first, and then it's transitioned more to I was having dreams about my former life as it set in that I was in the hospital. And so I broke my back at the T4 level, so that's right about nipple level. I have a complete spinal cord injury. I also have a mild traumatic brain injury. So my memories from before my accident are relatively hazy. You know, when people tell me what happened, like a story of, you know, this happened on this day, I'm like, oh yeah, like I totally remember that. But for me to be able to recall it independently is hard to impossible. So that's been a challenging transition and something that's taken longer to realize. You know, you break your back and you realize you can't walk and you're like, oh, well, I can't walk. Like, it's pretty apparent immediately. But the memory has been sort of a process of discovery as to what I remember and what I don't. Names have gotten much harder.
See, and that, I hadn't even really realized that, oh, like you had so many things happen to you that the traumatic brain injury, I almost forgot about until this moment.
Oh yeah. I forget about things that happen all the time. I mean, we could spend the entire hour talking about all the various mishaps and, you know, flap surgeries and bone grafts and peg tubes and, you know, abscesses and internal bleeding and wound care and, yeah, I was in the hospital for 3 full months. I think in 2023, I was outside for 4 days of fall. And then I got out of the hospital 4 days into winter, on Christmas Eve, actually.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Did you come with us to the zoo?
I did. I remember because that was like a big deal. I remember being, so I should say too, I am a bad friend. So Tess and I got out of college and then it was like the combination of that and then COVID happened and I just lost touch with like all of my friends. And you were kind of the first friend to kind of come back and, you know, I was like, oh, I have my high school friends again. And it was, I remember the night of your accident, just still not really having answers. Like your parents hadn't really kind of told people. People were, it was sort of like the rumor mill and there were people who said, because I understood that you had a spinal cord injury, were unsure to the extent what the prognosis was, that your arm was also, that somebody said that your arm had just was shredded, like that you had all sorts of crazy.
When I was first brought to IHC, the hand surgeon there, trauma surgeon there, almost amputated the arm, and thankfully they decided not to. I would have been a triplegic, which would have been even more difficult.
Yeah.
So I darn near lost my left arm, and that continues to be a problem for me.
And I remember that I was really emotional for a couple. I actually took a day off work. I don't know if I've told you this, but like this, it was the sort of realization. And I think like you and I think on the surface are different people. I think we kind of have different vibes. But in a lot of ways, I think we're very similar people. And what I was kind of talking about earlier, that we had this relationship with the bike that I think was similar, that you and I think like cared about it and had ingrained it into our personality a little more deeply than other people had.
I also think we both like nerding out over the gear.
Yeah.
I mean, lots of guys like nerding out over their bike, but...
But you and I...
Just a little bit more.
Just, yeah. I remember I was walking with Tessa... And it was just like, it was kind of dawning on me the enormity of, it wasn't like you'd, because there was a sec where I was like, I thought you were going to die. And then it was like, okay, he's going to live. And I was like, that was a relief. But then it's almost like as close as you can get to someone dying, you know, where it was like.
Yeah, I got pretty close.
Yeah. And then just realizing that like, this person is going to lose this thing, or in my mind that you were going to lose cycling. And for me, I was like, oh my gosh, like you're, cause you and I think we're kind of like almost kindred spirits over that. But like the other guys liked bikes, but they kind of, you know, like for us, I was like, dude, like this guy gets it. Like you got how I felt about bikes. I didn't have to explain it to you. And I remember that was like, it almost took me a second to, you know, come to terms with that. And then I remember,
spoiler alert, I have not lost cycling.
So, this is sort of leading where I want to go with this. I remember the first time it was a while before we could visit you was the other thing. Like you had.
Yeah. So the first three and a half weeks I was in the ICU, which then the only person who would have seen me would have been Jacob, although it didn't end up happening.
Yeah.
And then I was on the orthopedic inpatient service, and that was pretty, just like the room was small and I was so out of it at that point that,
yeah.
My grandma came and visited me along with one of my cousins, but that was about, you know, that was,
yeah,
it, you know, it was really just the very closest people at that point.
Yeah. Cause it's not like you can, I don't want to say there's no point in visiting you, but it's not doing you any good. Like,
I mean, I was, you know, I was glad to have people around, when I was awake. I didn't spend a lot of time awake. You know, I was probably sleeping like 16 hours a day, maybe more. And then, you know, some of those waking hours were dedicated to various medical things. They were drawing my blood 4 times a day because I was on blood thinners and they needed to know lots of things about me. They didn't think to take blood from my legs until the last blood draw. So I remember I only had one arm to give blood from because the other one was so jacked up. My poor right arm was scarred like a heroin addict.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the last day they're like, oh, actually we can be taking blood from your feet instead. And I was like,
oh,
well, this would have been nice if you guys had figured that out 5-6 days ago.
How many surgeries did you have in total?
Oh man, I counted once, but it's not, it also depends on how you count.
Yeah.
It's at least 12.
Oh my gosh.
So I think there were 5 for the arm. There's 1 for the back. There's 1 for the clavicle. And then, yeah, quite a handful of more minor procedures. And then several have since followed for various things. And yeah, I've spent a lot of time under the knife.
So we should shout out all the people who really knuckled down in school and became doctors because they like saved your life. I remember actually kind of telling my kids, I was like, hey, I have a buddy where like, you know, if someone hadn't, you know, like I said, buckled down in school and learned how to fix broken 12 different things. It was like a 3-week period. I remember, and I was kind of like getting to the point where I was like, I really want to visit you. And it was, we were kind of not sure when, and then we could. And to be honest with you, I was like glad I could visit you, but I remember the day of it was the weirdest feeling in my life. I was like, I have no idea how I should feel right now. I'm like, there's a part of you that's like kind of unsure and like scared and you don't know what to say. And I remember because I came with Tessa, and I remember we were driving up and I was like, what do I say? Did you kind of feel like when people are coming to visit you, there was like this weird, like, I don't really know what we'd like
do? There was definitely some quiet silence when people first came to visit me, but I think, you know, we pretty quickly just picked up where we had left off. We probably talked about bikes.
Well, it was weird, because and then I kind of had this moment where I'm like, he's still doing it. It's just like there's this thing that's happened that's gonna change a lot.
He can't really move at all right now.
Yeah, but yeah, I remember we were just kind of sitting down, and I remember I don't remember all the conversation. It was almost immediately, though, was like, oh yeah, so when I get out, we're gonna start riding again. Like, you were immediately on like the same thing we've been on for like almost 10 years to that point, you know, that was like, you were going to be back on the bike, you were gonna be back on skis. Like, that was you. I remember you saying
back on skis was immediately, because I knew mono skiing was a thing,
right?
It's
pretty well established.
I mean, people have been doing it for 50 years at this point.
Yeah.
And the skis have gotten good. And I very quickly was thinking about which rig I wanted and this and that and the other thing. And just being a gearhead. And then the biking I found out about just a little bit later. I became aware of it, and quickly it was immediately evident to me that, you know, an adaptive mountain bike is more than just a bike. It's a mobility device and a way to get off the concrete, which is hard in a wheelchair, honestly. Like I you know, scroll Instagram and people have their pictures of their backpacking camps up by remote mountain lakes, and I'm like, I don't know how I'm gonna get there, but the bike is really the answer, along with a whole host of other logistics.
So maybe to start, because this is what I'm really interested in, as a gear nerd, I remember kind of Googling like adaptive mountain bikes, and then you learn pretty quickly that like depending on what your adaptive needs are, things look different. Then depending on what your goals are, you have a very interesting kind of niche that you fit into where you want a serious mountain bike that you can actually do like real mountain biking with, right? Not just like, oh, I'm going to ride on an unpaved path, right? Like you want to do real mountain biking that you have the use of both of your arms to use of both of your arms. I remember it was a minute before we actually rode together, because it seems like there was kind of there was a lot of PT for you to do to kind of
there was a lot of PT back. And then, you know, the first several rides I was, you know, riding with adaptive programs
on like a borrowed bike, essentially.
On a borrowed bike, and it's just not the time where you bring your friends out necessarily.
Maybe we should explain.
Although I think I did. That's
you kind of did. I remember going on a ride where it was like, it was you were still learning it, So the bikes you're riding have two wheels up front and a single wheel out back. Starting just to help people understand. So this is an electric bike.
Yeah, so it's a hand pedal e-assist bike. So it has a class one Bosch e-bike motor in it, which will give 250 watts of sustained output as long as you're putting in at least 73.5 watts. And then, you know, it's hand crank. And then the real innovation in the bike that I have is that the front wheels are allowed to articulate and rotate independent of the back wheel, so you can really drop your hip into corners and like shift your weight uphill if you're on an off camber, which makes the bike much more capable. And it also allows the bike to have a narrower wheelbase, which with the more fixed frame tricycles, they have like a 36 inch wheelbase, which is quite a bit wider than most trails, whereas, you know, my bike has a 29 inch wheelbase, chosen, I believe, because it's the width of an 800 mil downhill bar.
Right.
And so the theory is that it should fit on most trails. Right. In reality, the actual dirt patch on most trails is narrower than that.
Right.
But it does, in fact, fit most of the time.
So just help people understand, because basically you're saying that it's not just like the wheels can turn side to side like in your car. They can also lean. So the wheels lean and turn. So I am pretty good at riding bikes. I remember up at Round Valley, you were like, hey, get on the bike and ride it. There's never been a bike that I could hop on any bike and do a wheelie on it, right? I got on this bike and couldn't move. It is entirely different and it's tricky too, because, there's no visual component to this podcast, but actually, what's the brand name of your bike again?
Ride a Bowhead RX.
So go Google image this so you can get an idea. You basically have one
If you want to see real ripping riding, look up Grant Allen on YouTube, and he has some free ride on the RX, which is unbelievable.
Because you kind of need to see this thing. I can't really compare it to anything. It is its own bizarre unicorn of a machine, that because you're having to pedal with your arms and steer with your arms, so you have this one thing that you're like,
yeah, there's a lot of your hands have a lot of degrees of freedom, so because you're spinning around, you've got like the handlebars, like the actual handle can rotate sort of relative to the crank,
right?
And then the crank's rotating, and then you have steering, which is like left hand forward, right hand back. And then you have leaning, which is like both hands to the left, both hands to the right. So there's a ton of degrees of freedom in your hands that you're managing all the time. So it's pretty technical to ride the bike well on trail.
Yeah. To ride it in a driveway is hard. I should say, like, it's so, and like Andrew's girlfriend rolled it. Like really, really hard for me to just move it. So like, go. Grant Allen, you said?
Yeah, this guy Grant Allen down in Australia is unreal on a bike. I mean, he's a like professional free rider before he was injured, and has just picked up where he left off. But he's done some crazy things, just amazing.
And it's cool because the technical capability of these bikes is incredible. Like, you can ride it, and we'll get into this in a sec. You can ride it on, I mean, there's not all trails are totally suitable for it, but you can ride it on some insanely gnarly stuff. I kind of am to the point where I could ride it up the street and turn around and come back and stop, but like, it's a handful.
It is. It's even more of a handful moving around when you're not in it, which, especially from a wheelchair.
So let's really quick, how much does your, cause you have a nice one. How much does yours weigh?
I think my bike weighs around 90 pounds.
So this is something that I didn't realize too, is that your legs are much stronger than your arms. So like,
about four times, which is why the motor helps compensate appropriately.
So, and this is an interesting thing. So you and I are kind of in this, we're always in the same sort of weight and size class, like guys we were racing with, your FTP is, you know, I'm like 180 pounds. Most guys have FTP is, I don't know, 250, 300 watts, somewhere in that neighborhood with your legs. Like a professional rider can be kind of flirt with the 400 watt. Like, what is your FTP with your arms?
So my FTP with my arms right now is probably somewhere between 95 and 100.
That's a lot for arms.
And then with the motor, that sort of calibrates to an FTP of like 350.
On a 90-pound bike.
On a 90-pound bike. So, you know, if you want to talk about it in terms of like watts per kilo, you know, the system weight is, you know, close to probably 120 kilos.
Right.
So it's, you know, if you were really pumping out the watts and got up to 300, you know, we're outputting 110 consistently, you'd be at 3 watts per kilo, which is like good, yeah, but not insane.
No. Because I remember that first ride we went on, it was clear you were working really hard and we were not going fast.
Well, so this was over a year ago now, and I don't even think I could have completed an FTP test at that time.
Yeah.
And then when I tested my FTP last fall to set up Zwift, it was about 70 watts or so.
Yeah.
And this spring and summer, it's really taken off, and I really have just been feeling much stronger and much, you know, really keeping the bike moving a lot faster.
Is part of it the arm coming back? Because I'd imagine that's like a years long process to get your strength back.
Part of it is the arm coming back. Part of it is your muscles sort of adapting to an endurance activity. If you think about when you're writing on a whiteboard, you know, pretty quickly that your shoulder fatigues, right? You don't use your arms in these sort of endurance capacities that much unless you're a swimmer or a rower. And so like part of it is building that endurance capacity in those muscles. So last summer I was worked, you know,
yeah,
even by the Big Easy Trail up at Round Valley, but it was never aerobically or like cardiovascularly taxing. It was that I literally couldn't do another rep.
Right. Like your arms are just on fire constantly, right?
Yeah, shoulders are just ablaze.
So let's say like if you had me doing it, because I'm like a relatively fit person, I'm pretty like I just moved, I can lift pretty heavy stuff, I'm a good cyclist. If you put maybe take me and then average person you scoop out of Smith's, like what do you think the FTP I would do is?
I think you would be doing quite well if you were at 55 watts.
And then maybe like, cause I'm probably slightly fitter than the average, like the average person, 30?
I don't even know. I mean, I think the average person would not complete an FTP test.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you could, you'd have to specially construct an FTP. Well, and I actually found this myself last year. I was like, man, like the FTP tests start too hard.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that first interval is at 100 watts and it's like, oh my God, I'm dying already.
Yeah.
So, you know, using the FTP light test helps, but then it's also the jumps, right? So if you think about like you're typical FTP test, it's a 10 watt increase as you go from 280 to 290 watts. And that's a relatively small percent increase. It's like 3% increase.
Yeah.
You go from 90 watts to 100 watts, it's 10% increase. That's a huge increase. Enormous chunk to bite off.
Yeah.
All at once. So, you know, it's like, maybe you make it through your first three blocks of the FTP test, and then it's like that 10% increase, and you're just can't spin the cranks anymore.
Wow. Because I remember, like, because you have a power meter on there, and kind of being surprised, I'm like, oh my gosh, like 70, because 70 watts, like, you could take, you know, I think most people could hop on a bike and produce 70 watts with your legs pretty easily, but with your arms, 70 to 100 watts is Herculean. It's huge.
Well, it's not that, like, Paralympic hand cyclists on the road and the fastest people on the bike I have FTPs in the range of 150 watts. That's the goal.
Because there are people who ride conventional bikes that have 150 watt FTP. That's unbelievable.
Well, and the other thing is the bike is naturally paced a little bit differently. Due to the motor being there, due to there being three wheels, due to the, you know, so to get into a little more detail with this, so the motor cuts out at 20 miles an hour because that's a class one motor thing. So, you know, to go from 19 miles an hour to 20 miles an hour is fine on, you know, flat terrain or whatever.
Right.
But to go from 20 to 21, you know, you might be, you know, if it's like slight downhill or whatever, you might be putting in 70 watts to maintain 19 miles an hour. And then if you want to try and move that up to 21 miles an hour, all of a sudden you're trying to put in like 150 watts.
Yeah.
Because you're not getting anything from the motor anymore. So it becomes very challenging, you know, on like false flat downhills, especially on pavement, to keep up with standing cyclists. But then on downhills, you know, the bike is so stable with your center of gravity low, and especially on like gravel descents, you fly past people. And then on, you know, gravel climbs also, having that sort of consistent motor output, you're pretty fast on the uphill too, and you also, you know, maintain speed pretty well. I mean, you have a lot of momentum.
Because again, just to help people understand, if you're driving, you can't like look up. You basically have a basket in the middle that you're sitting in.
Yeah.
The batteries underneath that, and the
motor underneath that also.
So it's a huge amount of weight, and it's not far off. I mean, it's what, 6 inches off the ground?
Yeah, probably 6 inches of ground clearance under sag.
And then I should say too that you have basically three. It's suspended on.
Yes,
each of the front wheels is independently suspended.
Yeah, so there's three shocks, there's three brakes, only two brake levers, and then I have the Tram XX1 transmission drivetrain.
I want to get to that in a sec because that's actually kind of been a godsend for you. And then it's the rear wheel is 27.5.
Rear wheel is 27.5. I've heard that there's clearance for 29 by 2.2, although I'm not sure believe it.
We tried to put my 29 with a 2.4 on, and it wasn't even close. We'll maybe look. And then the front, we're 24.
So the front, a lot of people on my bike in particular will run 20s because there is a bit of a hand clearance problem when you lean the bike over your hands at the front wheels.
Pedaling, maybe buzzing.
But I have found that with some modifications to my riding style, I'm able to avoid the hand clearance problem enough and benefit from the rollover improvement enough that I dread going back to 20s, honestly.
Yeah. And you've ridden this on pavement, gravel, and mountain pretty extensively, right?
Yeah, and even a little bit on snow.
Oh, really? You've taken it on snow?
Yeah, just up to the top of Mill Creek early winter, you know, really? Get on the groomed... It slides around pretty fun.
Because I was gonna say it's a really fascinating machine because it's a handful. It's funny because in certain circumstances it works really well because you have that insanely low center of gravity and then it's
like berms, like it rips. I corner much faster on the Bowhead than I ever cornered on a mountain bike.
But then, like, we were climbing 9K the other day, and on some of the technical bits, it's, especially if you have to, like, slow down, and then, like, getting it rolling seems like, and we should say too, and it's like, you can't even imagine, just go look up a picture. It has like a, so like a transmission cassette and derailleur on it. And you have a transmission shifter, like on a normal bike. So you're also shifting on this. So you have wireless shifting on this. And so it's like, you're pedaling a traditional bike. It's hard to like, so like,
you, so your hands are operating, with the exception of like how the steering is and like all that, but your hands position relative to the brakes and to the shifting is the same as on a bike. It's just that your hands are sort of vertically oriented instead of horizontal. But shifter is still like at your thumb, brake is still at your index finger.
Yeah. And it's like, it's pretty impressive the stuff that you've, especially just in a year. I was saying that like you've, it seems like you've really got the thing figured out. But as we were discussing, as we were setting this up, that you were still have, like, there are still mishaps, and that it's pretty high consequence when something goes wrong.
Yeah. So, shout out Bo Foreman, friend of the podcast, for
recently interviewed him.
Yeah. For the second hauling me up. So we were riding, Mother Urban, and we were on the sort of sagey section, up as you're starting to get close to John's. And I hit something with one of my front tires and rolled the bike off the embankment. And I, you know, barrel rolled 4 or 5 times before coming to a sliding stop.
You said on like a 50 degree slope, like on a really, really significant.
Yeah. So when I was getting piggybacked up, Bo was hunched over, obviously, but Bo's hands were, you know, Bo couldn't fully stretch out his hands before he hit the dirt in front of him.
Wow.
And it was a huge effort to get me and the bike back up that hill. I mean, if you think about getting an able-bodied person just walking up and down, that would be a big effort. And like doing it with a bike on their back would be really hard. And then you have this 90-pound tricycle that you can't put on your back, and you can't, like,
it's a fairly it's an unruly thing.
It is so capable and so mobile when someone who knows how to ride it is in it.
Right.
And as soon as that is not the case, it is so awkward to move around.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't have a, like, the turning radius is basically entirely dependent on your ability to articulate the front end, which you don't have if you're not in it, because you leave it sort of locked out. And so it's just, and it's heavy, and it's a bear to move. It really is. I've accidentally had it roll across parking lots from time to time, and getting the bike back up a slightly uphill parking lot to the car is something I try and avoid at all costs, because I've done it twice and it is so much work.
Yeah. And you've got a cool rack system on your van to get it around, but even getting it on and off is like, you, and this is a cool thing that I, as impressive as it is that you've like learned to ride this new kind of mountain bike, some of the more subtle like adaptations you've made in your life are really fascinating to me. Like, you drive, you've got a modified van that allows you to brake and accelerate.
It's really very simple hand controls. You push to stop and you pull to go.
Right. And that you can get into your van. You have like a rope pulley system I was worked out, where you can get into your van, get your chair into the van.
Yep.
And so you can
shout out the minivan.
Yeah. Like, you can, well, minivans are amazing.
Toyota Sienna all day, every day.
I actually kind of want one really bad, but you can, so you can independently get around, get in and out of your car, drive, like, but those are skills that you had to,
like, oh, totally. And out. Like, yeah. And I mean, learning to get in a car is not trivial. And then it's like, you know, you would never think like, oh, hey, I'm like getting a ride from this friend, I hope I can get in their car okay.
Yeah.
That's not a thought that crosses the able-bodied mind.
Yeah.
And every new car is different and presents challenges because sometimes there's a handle, sometimes there's not a handle. Sometimes it's higher, sometimes it's lower, sometimes runner plates, oh, yeah, like on trucks, are the absolute worst.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's, you know, it's this constant learning experience.
Yeah, because it's been like, more areas of your life than not, you've had to make some kind of modification, right?
Basically every single one.
If I could, like...
I type about the same, although I had to relearn how to type also.
I was sick because your hand was so mangled. Yeah. I'm curious, maybe comparing the experience of learning to bike and ski again, which are like lifetime competencies for you, versus learning how to like get in a car and get dressed. Like, what was the more challenging thing for you to figure out?
So of the things listed, skiing has been the most challenging, although if we're being really honest, learning to manage bladder and bowel function without the, you know, like everyone will kind of complain like, oh man, like I have to pee so bad, I have to pee, I'm uncomfortable, right, I have to pee.
I need to find a bathroom.
That reminder system is, yeah, a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
I miss it. I miss being reminded to pee.
Right.
Because sometimes you forget, you know, you're in a social situation and,
yeah.
The bowel sort of similar, you know, it's like training your body to be as regular as possible.
Right.
Which I never was. And so that has been more challenging than it was for some people.
Yeah. And that's gotta be tricky because that's gotta be limiting socially and it's gotta be an anxiety inducing thing.
Oh, absolutely. Like nonstop paranoia and paranoia.
Did you practice that in the mirror?
No, I've just told the joke before.
That's a good one. It was always amazing to me. Like there was a part of me that sort of thought, like if I was in your shoes, I would kind of go into hiding for years until I could figure out how to be myself. You are like you seem to get, and the other thing that I admire about you is you've always been very like willing to ask for help, which I think I would struggle with. That like you've always been pretty open about like, oh, hey, can you grab it? And you're like, oh yeah, this is what I got to do.
That has very much been a learned skill.
Yeah.
It's not easy to ask for help. It's one of the more challenging parts, I think, is socially. It's just like asking for help, but like when is it too much asking? And yeah,
well then for me it's also kind of like you want to be helpful, but then you also want to, like I've heard from, because my mom works with the disabled community, you know, so like my whole life I've had all the lectures on like people are still people, and like it would be annoying if people were just assuming that you were this totally incapable thing, that you needed everything done for you, and that, you know, like it's, yeah, that balance between not wanting to infantilize a person and support a person. And for you, it's a balance between I want to do stuff, but also practically sometimes it's just like,
right,
you know,
I mean, if Joe and I go on a bike ride, I'm going to have him help get the bike off because,
yeah,
it's so much quicker. I mean, if we do it together, it takes 30 seconds.
Right.
If I do it alone, it takes, you know, 5 minutes on, 5 minutes off.
Right. Right. Right.
Maybe not quite 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Three minutes off, five on.
And we should say too that there's other stuff, like you were telling me that like it's not really safe for you to go biking alone.
I cannot mountain bike alone on single track. Yeah. I mean, you with very limited exceptions, like I would go on Big Easy at Round Valley alone because, right, I've ridden it many times. I know the trail very well. It's very adaptive bike friendly trail. Yeah, I would do that alone, but beyond that, it's just, you know, if I had taken the fall I took yesterday and Bo wasn't there to piggyback me up, which one of the most unbelievable athletic performances I've ever seen.
Yeah, he's an animal.
That piggyback ride was incredible. You know, if I had been alone, like I would have just wasted away in the sun,
yeah,
for a long time.
Yeah. And that's and so this is like, It's interesting where there are still some limits to like you, and you have to, and I think it seems like there's a lot of risk management in your life now too.
Yeah, right? And I am still very much learning what those limits are, and I think maybe I'm learning it in the wrong direction. You know, like as you know, maybe the correct way is to slowly expand your comfort zone. And I'm sort of going like,
wide swings, burn your,
we'll try it and find out.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you don't get the great data set because it's like, well, I did something similar last time and it was fine.
Right.
And it's like, well, yeah, because you were lucky.
So you've talked about a lot that you've been doing some of the gravel events because those are kind of, I mean, like single track is difficult and more risky.
Yeah.
But even you had you were telling me about an instance you had where you basically had a mechanical that stranded you for a long time until someone could help you, right?
Well, so I was up in the Teton Valley doing the Teton Valley Backyard Rally a few weeks ago. And I had to struggle my way through about half a mile stretch of mud where a farmer had spite flooded his road. And then I came out of the mud and very quickly ended up with a flat tire, which I tried to plug and I got to hold like a little bit of air, but not a lot. So I was basically riding on the insert for, I don't know, 20 miles until I got to an aid station where I was able to swap a battery, which I desperately needed to do. And then I continued riding on the insert and like a little bit more of a fix after the aid station. And then the insert shredded and it just got to the point where I was like, I don't need to risk my rim to get home under my own power.
Yeah.
So.
And that's an interesting, it seems like one of the themes is that there's these extra few layers of complexity to just everything now that you have to be thinking, and that like the planning for you too, you know, has to be really, really intentional. And it's been interesting to kind of watch you sort of engineer your way around these technical challenges that you always seem to be looking for new ways to make it safer, more reliable, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, figuring out the tire setup has been a struggle. I've gotten a lot of flat tires this year. And I think I've figured out sort of the setup that works really well. And it involves, you know, very robust insert, particularly in the front tires. The, you know, with the poor rollover of a 24, you just bottom out the tire more frequently. And so having a pretty robust insert in the front tires and set up tubeless has been helping a lot.
But it's hard because like with 20, your options are so limited for like serious 24, like most 24 inch tires are not intended to be used. They're intended to be put on a kid's bike.
I can rattle off the list of tubeless ready 24 inch mountain bike tires right now. So you've got Kenda Booster Pros in 2.2 and 2.4. You got Kenda Regoliths in 2.2 and 2.4. And then you have Minion front and rear in 2.3 and 2.4.
And that's kind of it, right?
That is basically it. V Tire might make something. Schwalbe makes maybe. Schwalbe makes something. But, you know, for gravel style riding, basically you've got the booster and that's kind of your only option.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's because for me, I'm thinking like, I'd want like something with like a DH casing, just make it as durable as possible. Cause it does seem like a lot of problem on the front end, again, where the rollover is so bad. For those of you listening, like, you know, it used to be all mountain bikes were 26 inch and then they've gone up to 29. And one of the primary benefits of that is that when you have a larger wheel, like it basically fills in the gaps between rocks better. And so you said
it floats over the gaps.
Right. And so you were saying you bumped up from a 20. So you basically just have
the difference between a 20 and a 24 is shocking. Like it's huge.
And even still, like that kind of seems to be something that's dogging because we had a puncture on our ride too. Like you ended up finishing
We showed up to the ride and my front tire was flat.
Yeah. And so that seems to be, is that kind of your next engineering challenge, is figuring out like, given that you can't just go to a beefier tire because like six exist in the whole world, like what are your thoughts on countering that?
You know, the insert game has helped. Next effort to improve it is I'm trying Silka's super duper sealant.
Oh, okay.
So we'll see how that goes. And then I'd love to get 26 inch front tires on the bike. It's a challenge from a packaging perspective, but yeah, there might be a way.
There like also you, like might, a narrower 26 or something.
Yeah,
like that?
So I've thought about setting with the tour on. I've been fantasizing about, you know, taking the classic trip to France and you ride some tour stages and right. you know, go up to some of the cool coals and for that I would run 26 inch road tires up front.
Yeah.
And a 700C road tire rear, or like 40.
Yeah. Which would be do it, but then it's just where you have to, like, a mountain bike tire, you're just kind of running out of real estate basically before it just kind of becomes unsteerable. Is that the
yeah,
like with your hand, because you have to remember that your hand is basically
yeah, you hit your punching hands, the tire all the time. Yeah, and then eventually the wheels will come and hit your legs.
Yeah. Turning which, radius, I'd imagine, is going to suffer too, right?
Yeah, yeah. Bigger wheels, your turning radius definitely suffers a little bit. I don't particularly have problems with my legs hitting the wheels, although a lot of people do.
Yeah. Because you've put, how many hours do you think you've put? And I should explain too that this company that makes these is kind of the only shop in town, right? Like, there's not like, it's not like you have eight different bikes to choose from, right?
There's about eight bikes to choose from.
And oh, really? Okay.
And actually, there's more than that. But so as far as companies go, there's a sort of up and coming company in Germany that I've just started seeing on Instagram. There's Reactive Adaptations, which is just this guy in Colorado who will weld you a frame and then put it together. And then there's Sport On, which is also a European based company, and they make a few different models. And then there's Bowhead out of Calgary, and they make four different bikes, two of which have the articulating mechanism, which is what really makes them unique and generally more capable.
Right. And you drove up to Calgary to get yours.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. But it's almost like in the same way that I'm kind of always engineering my own solutions for my bike, you have a bunch of titanium tubing in your car right now
that we have to screw away. I have been working on redesigning the sort of cockpit area where the, like, where you would mount a Garmin, where you would mount a light, where the little controller screen and controller goes. Because what comes stock is 3D printed plastic. I actually have it right here, and it's brittle. And so if I had that on when I rolled the bike yesterday, like I mean, who knows where all my pieces and parts would have been. But as it was, there were some minor scratches.
Yeah.
But no significant damage.
So the actual,
which I was very pleased with.
So the actual, like, frame of your bike, for as much as there is, like, a frame.
You know, the main frame is two parallel, either titanium or stainless steel tubes, and everything is mounted on those tubes.
Right.
So the front wheels can't slide forward and backwards, and the rear suspension swing arm can't slide, but the bucket can slide forward and backwards in between them. And you could cut the tubes and make the bike more compact, but you'd have to be a smaller person than I am.
Do they sell it in sizes, or is it you just kind of buy it and then you slide the bucket to adjust?
They do not sell it in sizes. Sizes is something I would like to see. Because the bike is sort of, the bike fits better if you're, you know, 6 feet tall or have, like, 6 foot tall legs at least. Because you can, you know, as you move the bucket back, you increase your traction on the back wheel. And the difference that, you know, like 2 inches will make, you know, if your legs are 2 inches shorter, or your arms are 2 inches shorter for the cranks, like that 2 inches is the difference between comfortably climbing 15% gravel roads and 15% gravel roads being, like, very, very difficult.
Yeah. And it must be tricky where, like, you know, I ride at Specialized or whatever, Red Canada, like they have tons of people you're serving, it's a pretty limited number of people. Like, you just don't have as many solutions at your disposal because there's just not as much demand for sizes in this thing.
I'd say there's equivalent demand for sizes in that people come in all sizes.
Right.
But there's just, you know, there's not the economy of scale to make it's super practical to produce an extra small frame and a small frame and a medium frame and a large frame and an extra large frame, you know.
So you're constantly sort of engineering your own solution. And actually, I was going to say, like, coming back to like the transmission drivetrain, like the durability of that thing, like you rolled and like that's fine, right? So
yeah,
like, there's some commercial stuff that's available, right?
I was so impressed with the bike. I rolled it. The where my feet go, there's two tubes that sort of hold this foot plate on.
Yeah.
And those were very slightly bent. And that was the extent of the damage to the bike.
Wow.
Which was on, like, we got me back in it and like it turned on and I just started, like, was able to just start riding.
Wow. And then again, so it's two, you basically take rear shocks that suspend the front wheels.
Yes.
Same for the back, right?
Yep. So I have a Cane Creek DB inline air in the back, which is a nice shock. I've been very pleased with that shock. The front linkage is a place where I think there's a lot of room for improvement on the bike. And it's currently running float DPSs because they're the only thing small enough to fit in that linkage.
Because it's like a tiny little spot that you've got.
Yeah, it's a little single pivot thing going on.
Yeah. So do you see yourself like riding this bike for the next 20 years and constantly engineering your way around different stuff? Or like, what's the rate of advancement for bikes in this world?
I don't know. We'll see. I really don't know.
Yeah.
I'll probably build myself one before 20 years rolls around.
Okay. Well, this has been cool.
We'll see.
Well, dude, I really appreciate you taking the time. I mean, there's the whole thing where it's like, you know, you're like, oh my God, you're so inspiring. More than anything, dude, you're the same person you've always been, and I appreciate that. And I think you should, if anyone you want to shout out, like Wasatch Adaptive, and if people want to, like, you know, like, or like organizations for accessibility should be aware of.
Huge shout out to Wasatch Adaptive Sports, Trails, and the National Ability Center. They've been so supportive, and they do such a great job of getting people with all sorts of disabilities out into the wild and, you know, able to have adventures, and it's such a valuable resource for this community that huge shout out to all of them.
Well, dude, you're the best, man.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's been too long. We said we were doing this forever ago, so that's on me. But I make sure you guys check those organizations out. Throw some love their way. Dylan, stop rolling your bike. Keep it in one piece.
Do my best.
Do your best there. Thanks, guys. We'll talk to you soon.
All right.